excited, and but apparently endless growth is not in the future, and there are very good reasons for believing that that growth is does have its limits. It will end at some point, and this is recognized back in 1972, and now the 1972 study has been validated. And so this when that lesson sinks in, I think people realize that we've had poor people, we have insanely rich people, trying to fly off into outer space. At the same time, we have people living on the sidewalk in tents and dying of one thing or another. And the standard response we get when people question this economy is that, well, a bigger pie will include more people and help everybody. But apparently, a bigger pie is not in the works. We're going to have to take this pie and we're going to have to divide it in some more equitable way, which we haven't been very good at in the past. But this is where, this is kind of where our future, where the future of humanity rests, in creating a system of production that recognizes the limits and divides the prizes and the goods in a fair and rational way. And so I hear our music playing, and I end this show. This has been Fight the Empire, and my name is Per Fagerheim. And stay tuned to KBOO, your radio station.
In 2019, the FBI broke up a criminal conspiracy to guarantee rich kids entrance into top universities. But traditional ways that system has been biased are not against the law.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
In speaking about affirmative action, I realize that I am broaching a very difficult subject. Is equal the same as equitable?
Civil rights attorney Lanny Guinier was nominated to be Assistant U.S. Attorney General for Civil Rights in 1993. Then the Wall Street Journal dubbed her Clinton's quota queen, and the president withdrew her nomination. In May of 1995, as Congress began laying siege to affirmative action, Guinier addressed San Francisco's Commonwealth Club.
The issue of affirmative action should be part of an ongoing public conversation. It should not be something that we are voting on as if it is an up or down, right or wrong, black or white issue. In the process of having that conversation, I should also tell you that I'm very optimistic about the future, in part because I believe that my son, Nicholas, who will be 8 years old very soon, represents what I believe is the answer to some of the critics of affirmative action, and that is reevaluating conventional norms. And I would like to read to you from his journal, which he keeps as part of his second grade homework, with his permission. He writes, October 3rd, 1994, in response to a question about his family, "My sister is in college, my mom works a lot, and my dad often cooks. Often my dad has fun with me." And then, in response to the question, "Name the cozy spots in your house," he says, "Well, one spot is the basement, another spot is the kitchen. I like these spots because my family is in them with me, but my dad is with me most." So he is experiencing a very unconventional notion of family. And how does this affect his worldview? Well, I went to meet with his teacher not too long ago, and she was really inspired by a conversation where everyone was going around the room talking about what their parents did, and one young boy said that his mom was the vice president at a bank, and my son's response, according to the teacher, was, "Well, why isn't she president?" So that's the future. A black male law professor begins a recent law review article with the following story. Three of his colleagues tell him what they see when they look in the mirror in the morning. His black female colleague looks in the mirror and sees a black woman. His white female colleague looks in the mirror and sees a woman. His white male colleague looks in the mirror and sees a human being. Now, all of his colleagues apparently have a group identity, but they see themselves as belonging to different groups. Now, some people are now proposing that the fact that these individuals have different group identities is a problem. In fact, it is the problem. And that the solution to the problem is for all of us to become colorblind, to turn a blind eye to the experience of the white female or the black female when they look in the mirror. It's not clear, but perhaps what this means is that the white female should see herself as a white male. Or maybe that the black female should simply see herself as the same. My question is sameness what we seek? And is sameness the same as equal? And is equal the same as equitable? Now, affirmative action means inclusive action, action taken to include in the workforce or the admissions pool those who look in the mirror and see something other than simply a universal human being. These people, whether they are women or blacks or Latinos or Asians or disabled Americans, have been previously excluded from the universal category, just another human being. In this particular view, affirmative action means making exceptions to traditional universal criteria in order to include people who have previously been underrepresented, people who have been overlooked, people whose race or gender we is missing from the pool of successful candidates. Affirmative action seeks to hire, promote, or select differentially in order to take account of differential lived experience. Yet, for many Americans, particularly those who seem to be initiating this debate over affirmative action, acknowledging difference is the same as acknowledging deviance. Difference means less qualified. Difference means either more or less. And if we want everyone to pass through the same hoops to get ahead, then we must treat everyone the same. The remedy for past differences is present sameness. Difference should be avoided, in other words. Some say difference should be avoided because difference means overgeneralizing. To treat some differently is to treat with a false sameness. For example, Will Marshall, the president of the Progressive Policy Institute, the new Democratic think tank, suggests that one of the public's big problems with affirmative action is that, and I quote, "it treats all members of a group as if they're alike when they're not." He continues, and I quote, "the idea that the affluent sons and daughters of blacks need some preferential treatment strikes me as wrong on its face," end quote. On the other side of the spectrum, some progressives agree that difference is complex. The experience of most blacks may be different from the experience of most whites, but that still does not make all blacks the same. Treating, in fact, all blacks as if they were equally disadvantaged by racism may, in this view, focus on the partial truth that most blacks experience race-based disadvantage, but ignore differences of degree. Now, those who defend affirmative action generally offer several arguments in response to these criticisms. They say that if America is going to be a diverse society, then we have to have a diverse workforce. They say that America has done things that are wrong in the past and we have to compensate for past discrimination. And then some, such as Barbara Ehrenreich, suggest a third reason, that those aggrieved white men in particular who feel that affirmative action has come at their expense can, quote, console themselves with the gains that their wives have made. Well, I would like to talk about a different aspect of the affirmative action debate. Affirmative action, in my view, becomes a very conservative remedy if it only takes conventional norms as a given and simply makes exceptions to those norms for certain groups of people. What do I mean by all of that? Well, many people believe that those who get ahead in this society are people who have earned their status. A well-known politician said, and I quote, "The American dream that we were all raised on is a simple but powerful one. If you work hard and play by the rules, you should be given a chance to go as far as your God-given ability will take you." That was President Bill Clinton's speech to the Democratic Leadership Conference in 1993. Earning one's status, I take it then, means playing by the rules. And the sense is that there is only one set of rules, the rules, so that those who play by the rules are people with merit. These are the people we should reward. These are the people who succeed without the benefit of special recruitment or an enlarged pool. But my question is, what is merit? And does success really correlate with playing by a single set of rules? Is success based on a one-size-fits-all yardstick? Can we, in fact, use a single yardstick to evaluate a complex reality, including multiple kinds of intelligence, skills, and motivation? So what is merit, and is treating everyone the same, meaning equal treatment, the same as equitable treatment? A former labor lawyer who used to defend employment discrimination cases on behalf of labor unions told me that from his experience, discrimination cases suggest the tautology of the equation, that those given the chance to succeed are in fact the most likely to succeed. Those people who have been given an opportunity to do a job usually perform because they have been given an opportunity to learn the job. Merit correlates best with on-the-job training. And yet, what do we do in order to decide who gets a chance to learn the job? Well, we set up criteria. We decide who is the most deserving of the opportunity. But do those criteria really predict success on the job, or are those criteria actually a symbol or evidence of something else? I am basically arguing that merit or qualifications are both subjective and objective. I'm saying that merit is a way of comparing or ranking people, that merit is a hierarchy that measures people who are applying for particular jobs or opportunities. But merit involves predicting success or those most likely to succeed, and it involves predicting success based on some criteria or standards. And the problem with these two components is that they are not independent variables. They are related to each other. Merit is both objective and subjective. It is objective in that we can all point to external or exogenous criteria that test merit. We want people to do a job who are qualified to do that job. We expect to recognize and reward those who are qualified. But merit is also subjective because those who design the test are often exercising subjective judgments as to what should be tested and how the test should be performed. It is subjective because those who employ the test often do so even though performance on the test is not correlated with subsequent job or academic or life performance. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I did a study of gender and legal education at the University of Pennsylvania Law School that is relevant in trying to answer that question. We examined the academic performance of 981 law students over a period of 3 classes, and we found that the women who come to the law school have virtually identical entry-level credentials as the men, meaning they have the same LSAT, the same undergraduate GPA, and the same rank in class. And nevertheless, these women do not perform as well in law school. By the end of first year, the men have 3 times the chance of being in the top 10% and 1.5 times the chance of being in the top 50%. So these so-called neutral entry-level credentials are apparently not very predictive of actual law student performance. The culture of law school turns out to be more important than the skills of taking the test. We asked men and women what they look for in a law professor, and the men and women agreed in terms of the top two categories that they looked for law professors who were knowledgeable about the subject matter and who were enthusiastic about teaching. But then the men and women differed on the third criteria. The men said they looked for a professor who speaks clearly, who expresses ideas clearly, and the women looked for a professor who treats students with respect. Another example of this, the men said that they did not feel any discomfort about approaching law professors outside of class, whether the professor was a male or a female. The women said that they felt discomfort approaching law professors outside of class, whether the professor was a male or a female. The women were waiting for friendliness cues before they approached law professors. The men were waiting for nothing but an opportunity. So that equal is not necessarily equitable. For all of the students, it turns out, both the men and the women, the predictor that the school is relying on, and in this respect, Penn is not alone. Most law schools, in fact, virtually all law schools, rely on the LSAT, the law school admissions test, as a predictor of performance. And yet it's not a very good predictor, even of first-year performance. Now, women may underperform in first year compared to their LSAT, and males may overperform in first year compared to their LSAT, but no one actually performs based on the LSAT. The correlation between the LSAT and first-year performance is less than 25%. That means that 75% of first-year performance in law school is not explained by LSAT for men or women or people of color. So what is being touted as a merit-based standard, as an objective standard, is both arbitrary and exclusionary. It is arbitrary because it does not correlate very well with what it is supposed to be measuring. Race and gender are, in fact, better predictors of law school performance. But the LSAT is also exclusionary because it turns out that it correlates best with parents' income. In other words, within each racial and ethnic group, LSATs and SAT scores increase as income rises. These tests tell us more about the past than the future. They tell us whether one's parents could afford to send you to middle-class schools, where you learn how to take tests such as the LSAT. It also tells us whether your parents could afford to pay even more for a special review course, the whole purpose of which is to enhance your LSAT score. In fact, when asked what predicts life success, college admissions officers at many of the elite universities report that initiative or being hungry are the best predictors. Marilyn Lewis, the director of admission for Harvard and Radcliffe, is quoted in the New York Times as saying, "We have particular interest in students from a modest background. Coupled with high achievement and high ambition level and energy, a background that's modest can really be a help. We know that's the best investment we can make, a kid who's hungry," end quote. In fact, those with the lowest SATs and the poorest parents who nevertheless convinced Harvard that they should be given a chance to succeed did just that. In fact, they succeeded beyond not only their own parent status, they succeeded beyond what was achieved in the real world by their so-called more qualified peers. A study of three classes of Harvard alumni over three decades found a high correlation between success, defined by income, community involvement, and professional satisfaction, and two criteria that might not ordinarily be associated with Harvard freshmen: low SAT scores and a blue-collar background. So maybe this labor lawyer is onto something. Maybe what we mean by merit is the same thing as opportunity. Those who are given the opportunity to go to Harvard do better in life than those who are denied that opportunity. And those who are hungry for that opportunity succeed more than those for whom the opportunity was taken for granted. So how should a place like Harvard go about choosing who among us to award that opportunity? Well, some suggest that these objective tests are the best way of determining entry-level opportunity. But what about athletes or alumni children or geographic diversity candidates? Well, we say we can make exceptions because those exceptions are based on behavior or some other non-immutable characteristic. What we object to, these people say, is making distinctions based on race or gender. We resent being told that we lost out to someone else just because of the group that they may belong to, as opposed to who they are or what they might become. Okay, well, I can understand that. We don't want to exclude people just because of group characteristics. But on some level, isn't that exactly what we are doing when we use SATs or LSATs to admit anyone? Didn't the admissions officers essentially concede that SAT scores are a weak predictor of anything but first-year academic performance? Didn't they essentially tell us that SAT scores are an even worse predictor of life success? Most important, as my research at Penn suggests, what these SAT or LSAT scores do correlate strongly with are group characteristics, being white, male, and middle class. So that the strongest relationship with the SAT or the LSAT is not in predicting who you are, but in predicting who your parents are. They tell us what group your parents belong to, what neighborhood you lived in, whether your parents could afford to pay for you to take an exam prep course. They tell us whether you went to school with other middle-class kids. And in a society that is as spatially segregated as America, they tell us your race as well. So in this sense, in some way, middle-class parents and others have developed a code for merit that is, not surprisingly, correlated best with exactly what they have. That is, those who complain that affirmative action disadvantages white males are both right and wrong. They are right that affirmative action has involved the formal interrogation of the process of making choices, including reviewing and reconsidering the informal networks and so-called neutral standards that have operated in the past to benefit a fixed category. But they are wrong in that affirmative action, meaning the awarding of opportunities or the reserving of special preference for candidates based on some group characteristics, turns out it benefits white males the most, because that's the group that is actually doing the best using the particular, quote, group-based characteristics that we are relying on as being objective. Now, there's a widespread unease about a specific kind of affirmative action, not the affirmative action that may benefit white males, but the affirmative action that benefits blacks. And some express this unease in apparently race-neutral terms. They do not object to opening up opportunities to deserving blacks, meaning poor blacks, but they don't think Johnny Cochran's kids should get a leg up. They agree that diversity, meaning one or two super qualified people, bring a veneer of fairness and a basis for claiming the elimination of bias, but they don't think that we should go beyond our traditional or conventional standards. But if we have eliminated bias, and if the conventional standards are working so well, why doesn't the American workplace look more like America? Is bias, in some sense, also about perpetuating a status quo which only benefits or primarily benefits one group based on rules that that group happened to be in charge of making? Could bias also be benign, unconscious, and a latent preference for what is familiar, for what is known, for what is comfortable, and what is reaffirming of existing privilege? Now, this is not to say that all Americans don't feel worried about the future. In fact, what is happening now is that opportunities are shrinking. Middle-class families are worried that they cannot assure their children a middle-class lifestyle. And many middle-class families become more invested in defending merit because they see it as the only way of defending their opportunity to pass on their privileges to their kids. But let me suggest that affirmative action has very little to do with the shrinking of these opportunities for most Americans. All Americans are worried about the future, not just white men. This is not just about angry white men. All Americans, women, people of color, all Americans, disabled Americans, all are worried about the future. And the answer is not affirmative action. The answer goes back to something else that same well-known politician said. It's the economy, stupid. So the point is that we can use this debate about affirmative action to shift the paradigm. It is not simply about deciding who's right and who's wrong. It's about taking the legitimate concerns of people on all sides of the debate. It's about being committed to racial and gender equity. It is not about splitting the difference, but it is about taking all of these issues and all of these perspectives and having a conversation about our future, a conversation in which we move forward with a new paradigm, not in which we stand firm to defend the past. We've got to think about the future, not the past. And let me just close by giving you an example of how we might think about the future using a new paradigm. There's a school here in San Francisco called Lowell High School, and it's a school that is subject to a consent decree that was signed by a judge in order to desegregate the San Francisco public schools. Pursuant to this consent decree, no school in San Francisco apparently can have more than 40% of one group at the school. Now, Lowell High School is a magnet public high school, and it turns out it's graduated a number of distinguished alums, including the present Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. And the school uses a test in combination with grades to determine entry. And because of the consent decree, the school was using a sliding scale to determine who should be admitted. The highest score was a 69, and it turned out if you were Chinese American, you had to get a 62 out of the 69 in order to be admitted. If you were Asian American but not Chinese American, or if you were white, you had to get a 59 out of the 69 in order to be admitted. And if you were black or Latino, you had to get a 56 out of the 69, all in the interest of promoting diversity. Well, apparently a group of Chinese American parents have challenged the consent decree on the grounds that it discriminates against Chinese Americans. And a group of African Americans and the NAACP are defending the consent decree on the grounds that without this consent decree, you wouldn't have a diverse population at the school. Now, I presented this problem to a class I teach in which I challenged the students not to decide who's right and who's wrong, not to pit the Chinese Americans against the African Americans, but to figure out what the legitimate concerns were of each and then to see if they could come up with a new paradigm. And this is what they said. They said, why doesn't the school use a lottery? Why doesn't the school say anyone who gets over 56 on this entry-level criterion compete in a lottery? 56 is the minimum threshold that the school now uses to admit anyone. But, they said, if the school can show that people who get a 69 or a perfect score have something that the school values, they're more likely to win a Westinghouse Science Fellowship, or they're more likely to become a Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Put those with a high score in the lottery twice. Put their names in two times or three times to enhance the chance that they will be selected. Or if the school needs trombone players, put their names in an additional time. But this is a way of acknowledging the legitimate concerns of people on both sides of the debate. And it does not rely on a single standard of, quote, objective merit to determine who should be in this school. The single standard, if there is one, in the student's paradigm, it's random chance. If what we really mean by merit is giving people the opportunity to learn a job, then in some sense, random selection is the fairest way of deciding who is going to get that opportunity. But this is a complex world, so you may have to modify or mediate the operation of luck or chance by some kind of correlation between things that the school values and things that are present in the population. Now, obviously, this is not a perfect solution, but it is a way of rethinking the nature of affirmative action so that we can get to the question that I asked at the very beginning. Is equal the same as equitable? Is treating everyone the same as treating everyone fairly? We may not yet know the answer, and I am certainly not here to tell you that I do.
And I am saying there is probably not a single answer, but at least we know the question. What's merit got to do with it? Thank you very much.
Lanny Guinier addressed the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco on May 1, 1995, on the topic of affirmative action. Hope Lafferty edited her remarks for Wings using a Microsound digital audio workstation. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Thank you, Wings supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Burns.